Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, May 20th. I'm Ray Graff, joining us once again to talk about recent events, developments, and technologies in the field of climate change and alternative energy research is Dan DeLurie, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at Vermont Law and Graduate School and former White House Director of Clean Energy. Dan has over 25 years' experience, including as an executive with utilities and clean energy companies. If you have a climate change or alternative energy question, call us, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or reach out via email. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. The number again, 800-348-2551. Dan DeLurie and your calls coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Here to take your climate change and alternative energy questions is Dan DeLurie, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at Vermont Law and Graduate School, with over 25 years' experience, including as an exec with utilities and clean energy companies. Dan is the former White House Director of Clean Energy, where he focused on the decarbonization of the nation's electric system. A UN-accredited delegation head to the UN climate change meetings known as COPs, Dan is considered a pioneer in developing content, policy, and programs that combine climate change with new electricity technologies. Our number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dan DeLurie, how are you?
I'm good, Ray, and it's a pleasure to be here once again.
You know, first of all, how was getting back into the school year? Everything good?
You're referring to Vermont Law School,
yeah.
You mean? Yes. I'm not currently teaching there.
Oh, so it's even better.
It's even better. But I've been working with them on a couple of events that they're doing, one in the past and one upcoming in Washington.
Are you still the Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate?
Yes, I am.
Otherwise, I'll change the script for next time.
No, I had to step away from that.
Yeah.
Well, actually, the Vermont Law School loaned me to the White House.
Okay.
That's how a lot of people get to the White House to work.
And that's how I wanted to begin our conversation
sure.
today. You've had a few months now since you were no longer in the White House. Just let's reflect back on how you got there, why you were there, and what you did, just for a few minutes.
Sure. I think a lot of people may not understand what it means to work in the White House or how you work there. I mean, everyone knows that there are three branches of government. In the executive branch, there are all of the agencies, and they have their own staff, Department of Education, Department of Energy, whatever.
Yeah.
And then there's the White House, which actually doesn't have a lot of permanent staff. The White House, if you think of it as the hub of a wheel with a lot of spokes off of it.
Yeah.
There's the National Security Council, the White House Technology Council. Mine was the Council on Environmental Quality, or CEQ, which has been around for quite a while. It was established by Congress. And so that's the arm where White House staff work on administration directives, such as executive orders, which I don't think anyone had heard of before, but there have always been executive orders.
Yeah, not as many as in the last 10 years.
Yes, not as many. But so most people that work in the White House are loaned from an agency. It's someone who has the expertise, and the agency sends them over on what's called a detail.
Yeah.
But there are also occasions where a nonprofit or a university will loan someone to the White House. And that was my case. And so
Vermont Law and Graduate School loaned you.
Correct.
What did they get back?
Having someone in the White House.
Ah, I see. Just the prestige of it all. Okay.
Well, I'll leave that to the folks at Vermont Law and Graduate School to fill in someday.
Sure.
But But I was asked by the White House to come in and do something specific. One of the executive orders that President Biden did when he first got into the White House had to do with decarbonizing the federal government itself, decarbonizing its transportation fleet, decarbonizing its buildings, decarbonizing the power that it buys from utilities and other entities.
All right, let me stop you there. Sure. Decarbonizing transportation and such, I think I understand. But how do you decarbonize the White House itself, the building, or federal buildings? Oh, you better turn that. Well, I think you have something on that's making noise. You got a phone or something?
I don't.
Really? Oh, it's your laptop. Oh,
I didn't think that was making a noise.
It's making the sound down.
Okay.
So anyway, how do you decarbonize buildings?
Oh, well, actually, in the same way that we've talked about on many shows before of decarbonizing one's home. I mean, it basically comes down to heating and cooling and lighting. And those are the major, I mean, you have refrigeration and other things. So it basically comes down to energy efficiency.
Yeah.
And there's not that big a trick to it. There are some things now like virtual power plants, turning a building into a virtual power plant by using more sophisticated energy efficiency, more dynamically controlled energy efficiency, where you respond to price or environmental signals that your utility or energy supplier might provide to you.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. The signals that my energy provider provided me was my heat pump system costs an awful lot of money in electricity. We tried to use it as much as we could this winter, and it was a cold winter, and without augmenting it by using our on-demand heat that we have for the radiators.
Right.
I tell you, I've never seen electric bills like that before. It was insane.
Yeah, I installed heat pumps, is it 2 years ago now? And I don't have any backup heat in my house. It's a small house, but I was fine, you know, using the heat pumps even on the cold days in southern Vermont.
You were in D.C., though, weren't you?
I was for part of that. Yeah, for
the
first part.
Yeah,
before Inauguration Day, yes, I was in D.C. But I haven't looked at my bills yet, to be honest. And so that's
something. They don't call you? Hey, Mr. Delury, it's been a couple few months. You want to throw us a couple of bucks here?
But again, I mean, everyone's got his own situation, as we always talk about here in the show. When someone says, "Well, should I do this or should I do that?" And it depends on running the numbers for one's own case.
Yeah. So back to the White House. I'm sorry.
Oh, sure.
I digressed.
Anyway, yeah. So that's fine. So I was asked to come in to work on the fact that if part of the Biden executive order for the administration itself was to have net zero power, that is electricity, that it bought for all of its buildings and all of its other uses.
Okay.
The federal government is the largest electricity customer in the nation, and it's also the largest at many utilities. And so if you want to buy carbon-free power, then that carbon-free power has to be made. It has to be generated to be carbon-free. And so that means that you really want to be interested in what the utility's future plans are. Now, this quickly jumps into the growth of data centers and the AI
and
growth that is
fueling. Massive amount of electricity needed to do this.
Massive, like no one's ever seen before. Although now there's a little bit of skepticism being expressed as to whether all of those data centers will be built. There may be some phantom data centers out there.
What do you mean, phantom?
Well, they're, one of the biggest challenges in doing any type of power plant, big or small, is interconnection to the grid, is having the technical ability, having the grid have the technical ability to absorb that power at that particular location. And so you want to get in the queue as early as possible among everyone competing to get interconnected. And so that in the past, even before AI, has caused certain projects to sometimes be proposed so that they get in the queue early. But I feel like I'm digressing.
You and I are all over the place, but we're going in a general flow.
We're doing the weave, I think, is what we're doing here.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay. And so back to the White House and what I was doing. So I, the White House and all of the agencies like Department of Defense and GSA and all those had never really participated in the regulatory proceedings of utilities where the commission above that utility approves or disapproves what the utilities want to do. Okay, so I went in with having had a lot of experience in that. I went in to train, teach, organize, and coordinate a multi-agency approach to actually weighing in when those utilities were going to the commission asking to build things like new natural gas plants.
Right. And so that would be a no-no if you want to be net zero, right?
Yes.
But, and we talk about this all the time, isn't this one of the foibles of what you are trying to do and those of your ilk are trying to do in decarbonizing the power scheme, electric vehicles?
Did you say those of my ilk?
Well, those who...
Sorry, I'm just kidding.
So, you know, you have electric vehicles.
Yes.
You have electrification of things.
Yes.
But in most cases, the power is still fossil fuel generated. And how would the government say, okay, well, we can't take your power?
Well, incrementally, it's not mostly fossil fuel. I think it was 75% of the power that was added to the grid last year was solar and wind.
Right. So, added, but how much aggregate amount?
Well, we can't shut everything down. We have to transition, which is why it's important to have policy in place that puts everything on an equal playing field. And as you probably know or have heard, fossil fuels have had for years a lot of subsidies that perhaps in a decarbonizing world they shouldn't have. And so, but even with those subsidies, the cheapest power to add to the grid is solar and wind and storage.
How about nuke?
Nuke is cheap depending on which plant you're talking about and how old or new that plant is. But the thing that jumps to mind when you talk about nukes is there really should be a carbon price or some sort of carbon signal when things are evaluated, even to the point of when we purchase things, whether it be an auto or things for our home or whatever. I mean, right now, there's no, it's often called an externality. An externality is something that is not priced into a system, but yet causes harm down the road. And so you have climate change impacts that are not priced in to anything that we do. The rest of the world, for the most part, has or is working on having a carbon price. There was a movement a couple of years ago in the U.S., but I don't expect to see that again soon.
Let me pause you there. We're overdue for a break. Dan sure. DeLore is our guest today, 800-348-2551. I want to find out more about this so-called carbon price, and we'll do that and then take your calls after this. J.J. Johnson here on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. I never interrupt a trombone break like that. Dan DeLore is our guest today from Vermont Law and Graduate School, although he's relaxing and not actually teaching at the moment. Someday you go back to the classroom, you think?
Yeah, I do some guest lecturing now and then, and there's one course in particular that I'm talking with them about doing.
All right, so very quickly, and we'll get to the phones in just 1 minute here. You talked about carbon pricing in everything. What are you talking about? Explain.
Let me try this as an analogy or an example, and that's the federal highway tax that we all pay at the pump, at least for those people still using pumps. But, you know, that's embedded in there. It's a tax, and it is dedicated revenue that goes towards road maintenance and repair. And not to digress, but I mean, one of the issues now is EVs, since they don't go to the pump, are not paying into the highway trust fund.
Okay.
And so certain states are starting to pass legislation to require us to do that. But again, what you're doing in in paying into that fund is having funds available to deal with highway repair and maintenance. A carbon tax or a carbon price would be the same kind of thing. You would put a price. It would have to be calculated, just like the highway fuel tax is, and that would go into a fund which would be used to deal with climate change mitigation, adaptation, and resilience.
And who would be in charge of dispensing funds from that?
I expect that just like the highway tax and many other federal collected funds, it would be dispersed in block grants to the states to do.
We're joined by Dan DeLury today. 800-348-2551 is the number. And let's go to Broad Alban. It's Bob. Bob, you're on.
Thank you. I'm curious about current developments with respect to solar panel fields and the effective efficiency developments currently. My opinion is it's in the neighborhood of 22% or so. Any improvements that you're aware of? And in addition, the useful life of these large panel array systems with respect to water entering into the layers of the solar panels themselves, and therefore reducing efficiency and useful life. One other issue is on the commercial scale, developments of commercial storage of solar cell-generated energy. What can you tell us about that also?
Okay. Show's almost over, so go ahead, Dan.
Well, there's actually a couple things I can't answer here. I don't know what the latest efficiency numbers are for the panels themselves. I know they're improving constantly. I don't want to digress, but I want to drop in a little tidbit here, and because I've talked about this recently, that almost all of the panels that are deployed here in the U.S. are made in China, even though the technology for those panels and everything to go with it was invented here in the U.S. So that's an interesting issue to discuss some other time, perhaps. But so I can't really comment in terms of the current and progressive efficiency. In terms of the water, I can't comment on that either. I'm not familiar with any water seepage issues into the panels, I think you're talking about, or runoff, but I'm not sure I can address either one of those. Commercial storage, I can address. And I mentioned that storage now is right up there with solar and wind in terms of economic additions to the electricity grid. And there's now a thing that's known as long duration energy storage, or LDES. And it's not all batteries anymore. There's old systems like pumped hydro that we actually have in our region here a little bit. But there's also new iron flow batteries and other things. And I would encourage anyone who wants to see what is out there now for these long, and by long term, we're talking like 10 hours or multiple days or whatever. And you go to the Long Duration Energy Storage Council .org, and you'll find some information on that. So storage is one of the holy grails, Bob, that we need more of, but we actually are making great strides on that.
All right, Bob, thank you very much for the call. Dan DeLury is our guest today. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. And let's go to Steve in Schenectady. Steve, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Hey, I had a question regarding solar farms. I've been getting a lot of literature in the mail from different companies trying to get me to sign up with them. They claim that they'll lower my costs, and I just didn't know if you had any thoughts on how that whole process works.
Okay. Well, Steve, what you seem to be talking about is what's called a community solar. But let's first set the stage. So, yes, solar farms are large aggregations of solar panels that are on the order of, you know, 2 to 5 megawatts. It all depends on how much land and how many panels are deployed. Now, some of those are really the same as a power plant, and they are feeding directly into the grid, and there's no relationship with any particular customers like you. The other way that they're being done is called community solar, and that's where you as a customer can buy from that solar farm. Now, it may not flow directly to you from that solar farm. That depends on the wires and what's needed in order to interconnect that particular solar farm. But you would be a dedicated customer of the power that's added to the grid from that solar farm. And some communities that I would encourage, and I think I did on a previous show, communities should really be looking at this as something they, as a community or municipal government, can do for the people in their town or village. And that is, talk to a community solar developer, and you might be able to use even vacant, you know, government land, local government land, to put that there and then provide electricity to the town.
Steve.
So how do I tell what the difference is? Because I'm getting approached by NextAmp is the one company. Is that community solar or?
I've heard of that company, but I'm not sure I can or should comment on it.
Yeah, you don't want to get sued, obviously.
But if they're asking you to be your electricity supplier, then
it says National Grid will still be my supplier.
Well, okay. That gets back to what I said of where it likely has to flow through National Grid, and National Grid may be entering into the contract to, you know, route that electricity and get it to you, or it may be something different. I can't really tell, but it's not bogus based on everything that you've said, and especially if National Grid is involved. So it's basically right. A green energy option that seems to be presented to you, and you know, you want to look at it carefully, but I wouldn't necessarily look askance at it.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Dan DeLore is our guest, who was the former a clean energy guy at the White House.
I was one of the people at the White House working on good things.
How many people were taking orders from you?
I'm not sure anyone took any
really?
Orders from me.
Yeah.
Yes. I came in and I had the power of nudge.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
The power of information. I mean, I was teaching people and guiding them on things they hadn't done before, but yet the things made imminent sense once displayed. And so those things are easy for a nudge.
In your time in the White House, and this isn't a fair question necessarily, but we have seen Elon Musk and his cohorts dozing things, if you want to make a verb out of it. Is there, in your estimation, too many councils and too much? Could some of these things be consolidated in the energy field, only in what you dealt with?
Well, let's take the Department of Energy, which I'm very familiar with. I've worked with them. For them as a consultant on all sorts of things. I mean, I'd be the last one to say that there isn't the possibility of efficiency measures being implemented in a large bureaucratic government agency. In the White House, I want to go back to maybe reiterate or say for the first time how small the staff really is. And remember, in my CEQ, the Council on Environmental Quality, of 100 plus people, only two were civil service. The rest of us were fired, essentially.
Oh, at the end of the...
Yeah. And so anybody in, you know, the National Security Council, again, I mean, those are people that come in with a new president.
Yeah.
And I may have strayed from your question about efficiency or whether there's too many people.
It seems
or
like
whatever.
There are a lot of like what you did, seems to me, involves regulations.
Yes, but we were trying to do new things, you know, so that requires people to do new things that had not been done before. So I think it's fair to look at it that way. If you're not trying to do new things, or trying to do less things, then it's easy to talk about having less people.
Look, let's cut to the chase. What did you know about Biden's prostate cancer and when?
I think we have a caller.
Oh, yeah, let's do that. 800-348-2551. I kid my friend Dan DeLurry. Ed in Peru, Massachusetts. Go ahead.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Ray.
Hello.
Hi, Ed.
I'm very curious about this, but I heard it for the first time maybe a year ago, and it's hydrogen fusion.
Hydrogen fusion. Well, fusion is okay. Requires hydrogen, right?
Well, go ahead, Ed. Do you have any more you want?
Okay, I'll give you an example.
Okay.
Out of the think tanks in the Boston area, you have MIT, et cetera, Harvard.
Right. Right.
And what I know is there's now Commonwealth Fusion.
Yes.
But I don't know much about it. But I think I have a little an idea about the process.
Well, okay. It's the Holy Grail. The Holy Grail.
Yeah, how to harness the fusion itself.
Okay. It's good for everyone, since you're hearing a lot more about fusion, to know the difference between fission and fusion. Nuclear power is made by fission, and that's where you're splitting atoms.
Right.
Okay. Fusion is fusing those atoms
pushing
to create power. Pushing
yes.
them together. Okay. There are no fusion plants anywhere
yep.
in the world. There's now a couple of contracts that have been entered into by the folks who do data centers like Microsoft, and I forget who the other one was. Maybe it was Google, with a company that says it can do a fusion plant to serve a data center. But there have been promising lab results, you know, bench test results on fusion. But it's important that people don't, and I'll address hydrogen here in a moment, but, you know, we can't, due to the timeline in which we need massive emissions reductions of greenhouse gases, we have to be cognizant about what we can use to do that in the here and now. And this goes for carbon removal or extraction from the air or any of these things. Yes, they're going to come, but they're not going to come at scale in enough time to prevent some really bad stuff from happening. Okay, hydrogen. Hydrogen is commercially available. Now, you mentioned, Ed, hydrogen fusion, and I'm not sure what's meant by that.
Well, fusion requires hydrogen, right? So I think it's just fusion, isn't it?
I think so, but yeah. I'm not clear on that.
Helium out of that.
I can add something to
sure,
that.
Sure, go ahead.
What I heard them when I heard the folks talking that were out of MIT, they said it was hard to contain a plasma mass.
Yeah.
And they're working on that because it has a way of escaping. It's a container, or whatever they're using. They're using high heat. They're using hydrogen, and now they're using flakes somehow to keep it in a wad or a mass.
They've been working on this since the 50s.
In order to yield energy.
Yeah. Again, I mean, that's interesting, but it causes me to say, yeah, let's all root for fusion, but, you know, we can't wait for these things. They just won't be ready
yeah.
at scale.
Got it.
Because we got to focus on what we need to do in the here and now. And the here and now is not looking that good.
Well, fission could be done at scale very quickly.
Oh, well, if we're talking about nuclear power.
Fission, yeah.
Yeah, no, nuclear power.
Not as efficient as fusion.
We should all be supporting the return and expansion of nuclear power. And I've talked about in the show before where when I was a kid, I protested at the gates.
Yeah, you sure did. You and Bonnie Raitt, huh? Yeah, okay.
But once I understood climate change, I did a 180. And, you know, there are companies now that are working on developing new power plants. They're also working on developing smaller power plants called small modular reactors, or SMRs. But we also don't have those yet either. And it may be that the economics, and I get this from talking to nuclear experts, the economics may be better to do another large plant. But there's actually space next to existing nuclear plants where they had thought they'd build one and then the nuclear thing cratered. And so there's space to do one there, and that might be a good idea.
Let's take a quick break here. Dan DeLoria is our guest. 800-348-2551 is the number, and we'll get back to your calls here in just a moment. Basie and the Orchestra, that's Molasses, right, Zach? Molasses is the name of that one. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Dan DeLoria is here from Vermont Law and Graduate School, formerly at the White House. Very fancy pants guest we have here on the show today. This email from Joe in Pittsfield. The Saffir-Simpson scale of hurricane sustained wind speed tops out at EF5. Seems like storms are getting more destructive, and that suggests that there's going to be need for extending that scale. What do you think? Oh, yeah, that's the mic. There
yes,
you go.
Sorry. Well, I can't comment on the scale. I know of it. I don't know enough about it. But I can comment on storms getting worse. And that is one of the impacts of climate change, of increased temperatures and not just storms, but extreme rainfall. And, you know, I think we've all seen what's happened with these events where all of a sudden in one location, seemingly without a lot of warning, you know, 10 inches of rain in 24 hours. And that's where so much moisture has been, because warm air can carry more moisture. And so much moisture builds up that it just has to drop in one place. And it happened in Ohio and Kentucky. I mean, we've had it in Vermont and other places. And now the storms, forget about the rainfall for a minute, and the wind speeds and all of that. I'm not a climatologist or a meteorologist, so I can't comment too much. But the empirical data is there as to what's happening. And again, on hurricanes, where the Gulf of Mexico or the Atlantic is warmer, that provides more energy to these storms that come ashore as hurricanes.
The actual numbers of storms, I don't think they're up. Hurricanes, that is. I don't think
hurricanes fluctuate, and I think you're right on this past year, but I don't think it's all about hurricanes anymore.
Okay,
I mean, look at what just happened. Yeah, and so I'm digressing.
Yes, you are. All right, so let's go to the second question.
Okay.
If climate change progresses unabated around the globe, asks Joe, when will we reach that limit? Where it's all over, man.
Okay, if that's what the question is.
More or less.
We are living on a gradient, a continuum, a scale, whatever you want. To use. And there's no cliff. There are cliffs for certain things, like the melting of the polar ice caps or the melting of Greenland. I mean, those are trip points. But overall, it's the combined impact of all of the emissions in the air and all of the ways that they impact. Some places will be rainier than others. Some places will be drier and hotter and unlivable. So, but here's the one point I want to make is that I suspect that you've all heard the number of 1.5 degrees Celsius as used as the target that we don't want to exceed. Well, in my world, no one is using that number anymore. I was at a conference just a couple weeks ago, and a noted climatologist was using 2.5.
Move the goalpost.
There was a major report from a financial institution on Wall Street using 3.0. When they surveyed the official climate scientists that work for the UN under something called the IPCC, the majority picked 2.5, and the second number was 3.0. And you can go to Google. You can Google, ask what is the difference between 1.5, 2.5, and 3.0. It's not a linear scale, and the impacts grow exponentially. Now, the other thing I want to add is that those are worldwide averages, but Alaska has warmed up 7 degrees in the past, I'll say, decade.
Fahrenheit
without knowing
or Celsius? Exact.
That's Celsius.
Well, that's
sorry, that's Fahrenheit. Okay. That's Fahrenheit. Okay.
Right.
We in the Northeast have warmed up faster than other areas of the U.S. and the world. And so just like sea level will not, you know, the same sea level rise will not occur in all places in the world, temperature rise will be different in all places of the world. The rainfall will be different. The aridity will be different.
Dan DeLore is our guest today. The number is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Williamstown, Massachusetts. It's Stuart. Go ahead, Stuart.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. You're on the radio.
Yeah, hi. I'm on the board of a condo of about 51 units, and we're interested in putting in solar. And it seems like a very good deal. The bulk of the investment would be paid for actually by the bulk of the investment would actually be paid for by the savings in electric, the best that we could, our electric bill, which has been going up drastically. But a lot of owners are concerned about what about repairs and getting possibly needing a new inverter and things like this 5 and 7 and 8 years out. What kind of reassurance is there that we can still keep these things functioning for the life of the solar, which is supposed to be 25 years?
Yeah, that's
the panels.
Yeah, that's the number that I was going to contribute to 25 to 30 years. And the fact that the panels are recyclable, which is a question that often comes up, and there are more recycling facilities.
That's tough to do, though. We've had that conversation before. Paneling, solar panel recycling has been a challenge for a long time. They're getting better at it, but it's still not easy.
Yeah, but one of the challenges has been not enough recycling facilities at the same time because there weren't enough panels reaching their useful life. But we digress on that.
Okay, yeah. Sorry, Stuart.
So, right, yes.
So
the question is keeping them going for this time. Yes,
yeah.
The system.
I mean, I think the only thing I can say is it's kind of a contractual matter that you have with that. I mean, this sounds like a loan from the company, or is it a lease program, or...
No, we could go to the bank, and actually the bank
okay.
Accepted the savings as kind of collateral for paying this loan, because the paying of the loan of a 10-year loan is actually cheaper than the savings that we would be paying out on the electric bill, and so it seemed like a no-brainer. But on the other hand, will we still be able, are we comfortable that in 5, okay. 7, 8, 10, 15 years, these panels are still going to be functioning and we can get repairs? And also that the companies that install will still be around.
Yeah, well, that's kind of a contractual issue with that company. So it's hard for me to address that. But there will, I mean, solar is not going anywhere. So there will be solar repair people. There will be solar installers. There will be solar companies that will be around to take care of you if somehow the company supplying it is not doing that for you.
But ultimately, there's uncertainty in your situation, Stuart, and I think you're going to have to roll the dice at some point.
Yeah. You know, one thing, Ray, one thing I want to add here is, and I think everyone's heard about this, that one of the casualties in the budget bill that's working its way through the Congress is the Inflation Reduction Act and all of the tax credits for EVs and for heat pumps and geothermal and all of that. And that is true. The House bill eliminates all of that. So people thinking about doing any of those, particularly the EV, this is a $7,500 credit, which is good on the books right now, okay? That's a credit, not a deduction. And so, you know, there's a reasonable chance that this won't be there next year or at some future year. And so you want to take that into consideration.
How's your vehicle running?
It's running great.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah.
Did anybody deface it?
I had one small incident, yes.
Really?
Yeah.
And how did that make you feel?
Well, I mean, how do I, you know, there's a...
You drive a Tesla.
I do drive a Tesla, and I got keyed on my fender. And so how do I know, you know, what happened there or whatever? But,
well...
For a while I had signs in my window that said I bought this to reduce CO2 emissions, not because of him.
Isn't it a shame you have to put that up there?
And,
isn't it a shame?
It is a shame. I mean, I didn't buy it because of him. I bought it because I tried out a lot of EVs and it was a good car.
Okay. By the way, you wanted to talk a little bit about geothermal before the next call here. What did you learn?
Well, I think people know that it's possible to have a geothermal heat pump, but it's pretty expensive. You've really got to run the numbers carefully if you're going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the thing that I learned when I spent some time with a geothermal company when I was overseas is that you can put geothermal anywhere. We all think that you've got to put it in like hot springs or out west where there's geothermal near the surface. And you certainly do want to do that because it's more economical.
It's closer.
But there is heat.
Way down.
It just depends. But the promise for geothermal is for data centers.
Interesting. Really?
Yeah. I mean, it is putting... You know, or drilling down, tapping into it, and being a power plant that serves that data center right next door.
I mean, even given some of the enormous requirements for AI facilities, can you do it?
Well, it wouldn't be the single thing that would solve that purpose.
Yeah.
So, you know, we can talk about that, but that's a big issue, how we're going to meet, because the power demand forecasts are incredible.
Yeah,
I alluded earlier to the fact that, you know, those forecasts may fluctuate. Right now, utilities want to use them to build more plants.
Yeah,
and from a utility standpoint, you increase your base, your capital base, by doing something like a natural gas plant.
Dan DeLurie's our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Albany. It's Marco. Hello, Marco.
Hello. How are you doing? Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I just wanted to make a comment on geothermal, just because you just finished talking about. I have a cousin that lives in Munich, Germany. They started about 20 years ago. They serve about 1.2 million family on geothermal for their heating, and they remove all the furnaces from the land.
So, that's amazing. That's great.
My question really was about nuclear, and if I do understand, then nuclear power plant, they have zero emission. But what is the situation on the nuclear waste and the nuclear, nuclear waste from
that's
plant,
always an issue.
Then we need to, and as far as I know, we don't have yet to found the correct facility to store it properly. So what is the update on that?
I'm not sure I have an update, but you're correct. There is no one single dedicated facility for nuclear waste. For years, there has been argument and debate and more regarding a place called Yucca Flats in Nevada. I don't even know what the status of that is, because it really hasn't come up. There's been no new attempt to do that. So the storage of nuclear waste at our nuclear plants in the U.S. is on site. And the other thing, because I can't get too technical about that, about reprocessing and all of that. That's not something that I have expertise in. But again, one of the reasons I support nuclear is that I believe that we can technically and politically handle the waste issue better than we can technically and politically reduce emissions at billions of endpoints, whether it be autos or buildings or whatever else. And so I think That's the way we have to think about nuclear. But I'm sorry, I can't really talk any more about the nuclear waste issue other than it's important. I'm not trying to downplay it, but I'm saying, you know, I think if we put our heads to it, that's the one that we could solve.
Marco, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to North Bennington. Jeff, you're on with Dan DeLury.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
In a previous show, you said the most important thing an individual could do would be to vote to affect climate change. And I'm wondering with the current situation in Washington, if that's still your thinking as far as the most effective way to create positive change. Is that still the top of the list of effective strategies?
Yes, but I'm going to sort of steer in a different direction on that.
Uh-oh. We only have a couple minutes left, so don't steer too far afield. Yeah,
digress has been the name of the show.
Yes.
So, but one is, and I also want to put in a plug right now because one of the things we just talked about, and that is what other countries are doing.
Yeah.
Basically, other countries are doing more on every front than we are here in the U.S. And if you want to see more about that, I'm about to start up my newsletter again, which I had to stop while I was in the White House. And so you can get on the list by emailing me at DeLuryDan, DeLuryDan, @gmail.com.
And it's a good read.
Okay. Thank you, Ray. All right. So back to the most important thing. People need to turn their attention away from Washington and turn it towards their state and local governments. Okay, there's a lot that can be done, including replacement of some of the tax incentives. So I'm not saying, you know, I just don't know what to recommend as a strategy for Washington right now. But here's the other thing that people need to do, and I'm going to get kind of personal on this a little bit. And that is that people need to start being serious about the decisions that they make when they do certain things. And I know when it comes to EVs, I think that's a good example. I mean, I personally know people who have bought a new car. Now, these are people that are all in on the climate game and we have to do all this. But they didn't really give consideration to an EV. And I know they could have done an EV. And I think whether it's an EV or a heat pump, you sort of have to it's time to put your money where your mouth is. And if the numbers don't work, then that's fine. But you ought to really give serious consideration because I think you'll find that you can actually accommodate an EV very nicely. It won't change your life.
Okay, Jeff, thanks a lot. We're going to leave it there. And Dan DeLury, it has been, it's always fun.
It's always fun to have you. Even with all the digression.
Yeah, we definitely were all over the place. I don't know, you know, we were, by the way, folks, the lockbox is open. The reason I thought of that was it kind of wiped me out this morning pitching during the lockbox.
Yeah, yeah.
So the lockbox is open. We have a fun drive. It starts on June 3rd. It's June 2nd. It's Monday morning, June 2nd. Everything we raise now counts. So if you go to wamc.org and make your pledge, you're supporting programs
Yeah, and I
like
can
this.
Say that Ray looks pretty haggard here. So the more you...
Look at the time.
The more you put into the lockbox, the quicker he'll, you know.
You know what? Okay. Yeah, okay. I think your time here is done. Dan DeLury, once again, how do people find out about getting your newsletter?
DeLury, DeLuryDan, @gmail.com.
Man, thanks for being here. It's always a blast.
Appreciate it.
We'll see you next time. Support comes from Capital Roots, celebrating 50 years of making local food and green spaces accessible to all through mobile markets, community gardens, and innovative programs. CapitalRoots.org. Chester Wood, the Gilded Age home and studio of American Renaissance sculptor Daniel Chester French, open for guided tours, new exhibition galleries, and blooming gardens, located in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, ChesterWood.org. At Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany, Dr. Tom Denham providing individual career guidance, career testing, job strategies, interview preparation, resume and cover letter writing, accepting new clients. CareersInTransitionLLC.com. Once again, thanks to Dan DeLury for being here today. Thank you for listening. Great calls, great emails, as always. Thanks to Zachary Malloy, who handled the controls over there in Master Control. Ed Rosen screened the phones today. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's Physical Therapy with Matthew Goodemote although I think he may have shown up today, which would be a problem, and I hope he's not upset, and I hope he still comes tomorrow. Otherwise, we'll spin some tunes and take a few calls. We'll see you tomorrow at 2.